Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we wrap up our week-long look at energy in Michigan with a focus on wind. Is it really a viable energy source for our state? And then we turn to Flint to find out how some residents are helping to shape their community through different kinds of art. But first, economic development leaders in Michigan like to talk about the number of manufacturing jobs created in the state in the last couple of years. But Michigan is not keeping up with the overall job growth of some other states as the nation recovers from the Great Recession. It's Thursday, which means we talked to Daniel Howes, business columnist with the Detroit News. Daniel, earlier this week, I was questioned by a reporter who works for the free market think tank Mackinac Center for Public Policy about a term I used. I described job growth in Michigan as anemic. Your column seems to support that description. What are some of the numbers and how do they compare to other states?
Yeah, I think it really does support it, frankly. You know, we've done very well in manufacturing jobs, leading the nation, about 50% ahead of number two Texas. But overall, from percentage gains, we rank about 30th, according to the Pew Charitable Trust Stateline Unit. Over the last 12 months, we created 32,300 jobs, which compares to 34,100 in Indiana, but my favorite is Texas was 10 times at 326,000 plus in that same period. So, and even the economic basket cases of California and New York are doing a heck of a lot better. And North Carolina, which has a population almost identical in size to Michigan, was creating jobs at twice the rate. I think they did somewhere north of 73,000 for a much better growth rate. So we clearly have got a lot more work to do here, and I think the economic problems with the city of Detroit teetering on the edge of bankruptcy is not going to help. And some of the macroeconomic conditions that we're seeing, rising interest rates, slowing growth rates, the second quarter GDP did not come in as strong as economists expected. So it's not going to be an easy haul. And I think the broader issue, too, is that there's a bit of a policy stalemate in Lansing, which isn't helping things.
Right. I want to talk about that a little later, but I want to talk about this first. Your column seemed to suggest that we're falling back into that pattern of being too reliant on the auto industry. That's something Governor Snyder has warned about, saying we need to diversify. But the governor is getting pushback from his own party on some of the things he wants to do to make the economy more robust. What are some of the things you're concerned about?
Well, I think he's raising some very smart issues about higher education spending, for example, and there are other policy issues. He wants to expand Medicaid, but he's gotten into an ideological battle in his own party. I think what people need to remember here, particularly the people on the right side of the Republican Party, is that the kind of people that might want to invest in Michigan maybe take a little bit more Catholic with a small C view of what makes a vibrant community. And one of those things clearly is an entrepreneurial culture. It's also an educated population. And we just clearly are not keeping pace with that. And that's not a partisan argument so much as it's a factual one.
How does Medicaid expansion and more money for roads fit into that?
Well, clearly, I think more money for roads speaks to the quality of life and just moving around the state. I mean, you don't – any of your listeners know what the roads can be like in Michigan. And I think the governor makes a fairly compelling argument about pay now or pay a lot more later. The problem with that is twofold. One is it's very hard to get elected and sitting politicians to think 10 and 20 years down the road. As a practical matter, they typically don't do that because it's not in their political interest. And secondly, of course, is a real political complication, and that is raising gas taxes to fund it. And that's very unpopular. It's unpopular all over the country. You see that in the context of environmental laws and fuel economy regulations at the federal level, and now you're seeing it here in Michigan, and it should be no surprise.
This kind of seems to boil down to an ideological struggle between the governor, a numbers guy, and the rank and file of the legislature who are looking at issues beyond the economy. How does that affect the ability of the Republican majority to effectively govern the state?
Well, I think it complicates it, and I don't think it's going to get any easier as we get closer to the 2014 elections. And I think that's part of the point here, isn't it? Is that we kind of are – there was a consensus early on in Snyder's term. They had both houses. The Republicans controlled both houses. They had a new Republican governor after 8 years of Jennifer Granholm. They knew that the budget was a mess. They knew that they had to do some stuff on taxes. There were some things that were pretty obvious that they coalesced around, and they moved it through. Now, as you get on the other side of this, I think that there's been a lot more pushback. Right to work was a very good example. I don't think that's something the governor necessarily wanted to do, but he got into a situation where he didn't have much of a choice, he felt politically. And now I think you move into the next chapter, and I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. I mean, the spectacle of the governor of Michigan going around the state and essentially lobbying his own party and hectoring his own party in his own Senate is, I don't think, particularly attractive. I mean, we've certainly seen that from Barack Obama going around the country and beating up on Republicans, but you don't see him going around the country beating up on his own party, and I think that's the difference here.
Yeah, you wrote, contention is the new consensus on what's next. You want to further explain what you mean by that?
Well, I just think they're going to continue to argue about this. I think you're going to have a Senate particularly that is worried, some of whom are going to be standing for re-election are worried that they're going to get primaried by Tea Party Republicans. And as a result, it's going to be a very difficult argument that the governor has to make to them to get him to move on some of the things that are important to him, like road funding, one example.
I want to go back to the idea of these manufacturing job numbers being fairly decent. You quoted the CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, Doug Rothwell. He said about some of these job growth numbers in the manufacturing sector, quote, "This is typically the time when Michigan goes back to its old ways," unquote. What does he mean by that?
I think he means pretty much the cyclicality by getting comfortable. We're doing well enough. Listen, one of the hallmarks of the culture, I think, and writing about the business and financial culture of both the public sector and the private sector here is that good enough is good enough. And that's historically been kind of the attitude. And I think what you've seen with the auto companies coming out of bankruptcy, and they actually realized it, I think, before they went into bankruptcy, that good enough was no longer good enough. And you had to be better. You had to keep leaning forward. You had to be pushing to be competitive. And I don't think there's any question that that is the case. And I think what Doug's point is that how we don't know how much of that understanding has really seeped into the public consciousness. You look at a state like Texas, their job creation rates are off the charts. But then you start to look a little deeper into the structure of the state, and it's very different than a state like Michigan from a tax base or tax its tax load to business creation to a whole host of other things. And those are real. And capital is more mobile than it's been in any time in human history. And people have choices, and they don't have to come to Michigan. They certainly don't have to stay here, and particularly if they've got a mobile business, and increasingly they do. You look at somebody like Quicken Loans in downtown Detroit. They're there because their founder wants to be there. But let me tell you, he could move that business out of there in a weekend if he wanted to, because of the kind of business he is. It's just a bunch of people and computers, and that's and an internet connection, and that's basically that business. So people need to recognize that if you're not competitive, people will leave. And we've seen it, and we'll see it again. And I think that's what Doug's concern is. And it's my concern, too, is that we're doing well enough that people will start to become complacent again. And you'll get petty fights in the legislature like you're already getting, and they're taking their eye off the ball, and they're worrying about their own petty political problems than they are trying to make Michigan more attractive.
Okay, so bottom line this for me. How do you assess where we are and what we need to do to get where we need to be in Michigan?
Well, I think bottom line is, we're only through about the, midway through the maybe the second quarter, to use a borrow a football metaphor. And I think we need to be a little bit focused on a little bit more about what works and what needs to be done as opposed to what fits into ideological boxes. I do think in some cases that the right wing of the party that has a tendency to say no to everything, no can be a legitimate policy answer, but I don't think it can always be the policy answer. And that's a real problem, and that will continue to cleave the party. So, you know, I think road funding is important. I think higher ed is important, very important. But it's going to be a heavy lift. I think more accountability in the public sector is important. We here in Southeast Michigan are just inundated with scandal in Detroit and Wayne County. We need a rather major house cleaning. I don't think that helps us because all that is very public in a 24/7 news cycle and Google. People know all the stuff that goes on here, and it isn't a very flattering picture.
Daniel Howes is business columnist with the Detroit News and joins Stateside every Thursday. Thanks, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we talk wind energy in Michigan, and then we'll hear what one community-based theater group is doing in Flint to help people tell their story. That's in about 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The potential of wind energy is just beginning to be realized in the U.S. Some states have been embracing this technology to create electricity. Michigan's been a little slower to put up as many wind turbines. Our guests to talk about wind and Michigan are Mark Cleavy, he's co-chair at the Great Lakes Wind Collaborative, and Victoria Pebbles, program director with the Great Lakes Commission. Mark, let's get started with an overall description of wind energy in Michigan. How much of our electricity is produced by wind today?
We have roughly 1,000 megawatts of wind in place, and the percentage of wind in total, we have a 10% renewable energy portfolio standard. The vast majority of that standard is being met by wind. And, you know, although that we were, I guess, a little bit late in the game, we came into the wind game in a really good time, because the price of wind dropped dramatically during the period of time that Michigan was involved in this, and it continues to drop. And that's due primarily to large-scale technological improvements, in many cases the way that Michigan, it was very innovative in some of the ways that they did it. So we're actually in a very good position. In fact, wind came in so much cheaper than originally planned on some of the projects that utilities actually rebated some of their customers, consumers' energy, for example. So it was a good time. We're in a position where the wind that we have, we don't have to worry about it being so expensive that we're actually going to be losing money going forward because of the way energy prices are. So we're in really good shape. Also, I think the benefit that it encouraged wind manufacturers to diversify from the auto industry, the pleasure boat industry, and other industries, tool and die industries, et cetera, to diversify into this industry. And now their activities in Michigan have allowed them to open up and become worldwide players in this growing and highly competitive market that's very much based on technological breakthroughs in composites, materials, things like that. So it's in Michigan's sweet spot.
Right. I want to get into both of those topics a little further. I want to compare, though, Michigan's production with states like Indiana or Minnesota.
Some of those states have larger renewable energy portfolio standards, so they've been at the game longer, so they just simply have more wind power in place than we do.
There's been some talk about wind turbines off the western shore out in Lake Michigan. What kind of potential, Victoria, would offshore wind turbines offer?
Offshore wind turbines offer the potential to meet, to be closer to where the people are, which are called load centers. So if you look at wind resource maps across the Great Lakes region on land and offshore, a lot of the really high-quality wind is located in the plains areas, lower-lying areas, which are often far away from where the people are and the electrical demand is. With the exception of offshore, you have very high wind resources over the lakes, which is close to a lot of the coastal communities, large places like Cleveland, Chicago, and so forth.
Recently in Michigan, some legislators introduced a bill that not only would block wind turbines in Lake Michigan, but it would even block research to see if it's feasible. We saw the same sort of controversy near Cape Cod in Massachusetts. That project finally is going ahead. What's likely to happen in Michigan?
I think that it's unfortunate. I don't think we should cut off any opportunities to do research and look at how the Great Lakes region, the state of Michigan, or even the country at large can provide clean and secure energy resources. Research is the primary way that we discover new energy sources, and it's been the way of our country in the past and going down the future. So I think it's unfortunate to cut off those opportunities. If the research shows that it's not a viable opportunity, that's one thing. But to cut off before we've even done the research is unfortunate.
I'm wondering if we've seen a lot of wind turbines in any of the Great Lakes water. I understand Cleveland is planning to put out a turbine or maybe some turbines in Lake Erie. How important would a pilot project like that be for the rest of the Great Lakes region?
It would be essential. That is the opportunity for us to actually see what the impacts are, both environmentally, economically, even as well as socially. How will the local communities that are linking the wind turbines to the nearby transmission, for example, how would they benefit? What would their impacts be? What would the impacts be over the larger region as well as locally? It's essential to monitor those areas to see what impacts might be on fish habitat and other aquatic resources, as well as what the generating capacity is. We're estimating right now what it might be, but we won't know until we actually put a pilot project in place.
Now, it's not just the offshore turbines that are controversial. Some residents in Riga Township in Lenawee County have been fighting a proposed wind farm there. There's been a controversy at other sites as well, concerns about the noise of the turbines, the problems they cause for migratory birds. How significant, Mark, are these concerns, and how significant is the opposition?
Well, Michigan, as you know, is a home rule state, so local zoning and permitting and, of course, taxing of these things is the purview of the local governments. So I would say that any community has the right to determine what kinds of development happens in that community. A number of communities in Michigan, Gratiot County and others, have chosen to put wind in, and some other communities have chosen to not do it. I know that some of those same communities that were less than favorable on some of the ideas of wind are openly embracing the idea of doing community solar and our solar farms and things like that, and then adopting solar ordinances to allow individuals to put solar on their houses because they think that is less obtrusive. So I think it's a question of the local community, what they want, and what their future is. And I think they're expressing themselves democratically, and they're saying that they don't want this development in their community. Others are saying that they do, and the reasons why someone would want the development or not, I think, are pretty straightforward. Some of it is, is just preference over what they see and hear.
You mentioned Gratiot County. It's the largest wind farm in Michigan right now. It's been in operation for a year this month. How are residents there feeling about it about now?
The feedback that we get is they're happy about it, and there's a number of benefits. We did a best practices review of best practices across the Great Lakes, and Gratiot County was listed as a best practice for wind development for a number of reasons. One is farmland preservation. It was the best option for that because the community, everyone in the community received a financial benefit from the wind farm. They were actually able to increase the footprint for where the wind would be developed. So typically, if you develop a wind, you go into a geographic area, and it's a limited geographic area. So the idea is to pack as many wind turbines in the area as possible. If you're dealing with a larger footprint, you have the freedom and the luxury of spreading them out. And if you have that luxury, you have the freedom to put them on property lines instead of in the middle of fields. So you minimize the farming, et cetera. So I think on balance, we've heard primarily positive things from it, and they're talking about expanding them now.
We're talking with Mark Cleavy. He's a co-chair at the Great Lakes Wind Collaborative and Victoria Pebbles, program director with Great Lakes Commission. Victoria, last year I visited a new manufacturing plant in Monroe, Michigan, where they're making the towers for wind turbines. We've also seen several small manufacturers making components of wind turbines in Michigan, as Mark had mentioned earlier. What's the potential for increased production and jobs because of wind turbine manufacturing?
There's great potential. As you know, the Midwest and the Great Lakes region is the heartland of manufacturing for the United States. We have tremendous capacity. A lot of that capacity has not been used in most recent years because of the slowing down of the economy, and people are looking for jobs. That's no new news to anyone. And those manufacturing jobs, some of them can be filled by the wind energy industry. We at the Great Lakes Wind Collaborative recently completed a study looking at just the offshore piece, and we would love to look at the onshore piece as well, the benefits that accrue not only from an individual state, but having multiple states in a region produce different parts for a wind turbine. There are 8,000 component parts, so some of those might be produced in Ohio, and some might be in Michigan and Indiana, and there are a great capacity to leverage the manufacturing capability of the region to support a robust wind energy.
I know that some of these wind turbines are being actually imported from, is it Sweden? I think the bulk of them are being imported from. I'm just wondering, does the state right now have the incentives in place, or all of the states in the Great Lakes region have the incentives in place to attract these manufacturers and the additional wind capacity?
The states have a patchwork of different incentives and even some disincentives for attracting the manufacturing. That's more of a detailed discussion, but there are a variety of incentives. I can touch on them very quickly. And they are not just for the manufacturing, but also for incentives for the market in general. Of course, you're familiar with the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which was a very hot topic in Michigan this last fall.
Right.
And the associated REC market, a renewable energy credit market that goes along with Renewable Portfolio Standards, that's just one policy. But there are other policies that can be initiated at the state level that can provide incentives for manufacturing and the industry at large, such as low-interest financing, tax incentives such as accelerated depreciation there, that happens at the federal level. It can also be complemented at the state level. Transmission upgrades. A few years back, Michigan established wind energy resource zones where it was targeted high-wind wind energy resource areas with high transmission capacity. So making sure the transmission is in place to receive and distribute that energy. Clear siting policies that deal with issues like visual impacts and wildlife, potential wildlife impacts. When those issues are thought through and the policies are clear, that helps as well. And then taxing policies at the state level that are supported locally can also help.
So there's a lot of policy making that needs to be done in Michigan before we're really where we should be in this industry. Let's talk about the goal here, more renewable energy, less pollution, less greenhouse gas emissions. At this point, the renewable standards in Michigan are fairly modest compared to more progressive states. I'm wondering, are we on target to meet the existing 10% by 2015 mandate? Mark?
We are absolutely on target to meet that mandate, and we'll probably in some cases even exceed that mandate. And I think we're also in a very good shape for determining what the next phase will be. So several things are changing, I think, globally in terms of how renewable energy is looked at and how it's incentivized or disincentivized within various states and various communities. But the technology breakthroughs are allowing for the price to drop on wind energy a lot. And there's a movement towards distributed energy generation that has come about primarily because of technological changes.
Wind is about 95% of all renewable energy generated in Michigan, according
Yes.
to the figures I have.
Yes.
Should we be investing in some of these other alternatives, such as more solar or more biofuels? What's the best balance?
So I think the best balance comes down to economics. And the other associated benefits are based on how one goes about doing this. So in Traverse City, for example, the municipal utility there is allowing individual ratepayers to buy into a community solar project. That the way of doing that could be extended to biomass, could be extended to wind projects, et cetera. So how it gets done really determines the kinds of benefits you're going to get. If a business builds a wind power plant directly, puts it on site and bypasses the utility. So they're basically putting on they're calling it distributed generation, but they basically build their own power and put it on site, large employers. They get benefits, but mostly they get 25 years of stable pricing. So that gives them a real competitive advantage in the global marketplace if they can take energy off the risk, business risk side of their annual analysis of what they need to be worried about. So the difference between having an investor-owned utility invest in a wind farm and then selling that power to a private company versus that private company simply going directly to the wind industry and buying a wind farm directly. Global companies are looking at moving into this industry directly because it makes sense for them. They know what their energy price will be for the next 25 years if they finance an array, a solar array, or a wind farm.
Victoria, the constitutional amendment proposed last year called for 25% renewable energy by 2025. That proposal failed. What do you think state government should do, if anything, after we meet the current mandate in 2015?
Well, I think the one of the issues with that was that it was tied to the Constitution. It was the method by which the increased portfolio standard was pursued. So it's really unclear whether the voters were voting against RPS, increasing renewables, or whether they were against the method. Many people I spoke with just didn't like tying it to the Constitution. A 25 by 25 is consistent with many of our neighboring states. Illinois has a 25 by 25. Ohio has 25. Minnesota has 25. New York has 29 by 25. So with the current RPS, it's on the relatively low scale compared to our neighboring states in the Great Lakes region. But as Mark said, I think the RPS is only one tool in the toolbox. The other policies that I mentioned previously are things that could be considered by the state and worked in cooperation with local governments, depending on how the authorities lie, such as tax incentives, accelerated depreciation, transmission improvements, that's the purview of the state, clarifying how siting is done, that's mostly done at the local level, but some guidance can happen at the state level to help locals and enable them to do that efficiently.
Victoria, I want to talk about one thing that is brought up again and again and again by particularly people who are fans of fossil fuels, and that is we hear that renewable energy will have only limited potential because sometimes the wind doesn't blow, the sun doesn't shine. At the same time, we've seen some pretty innovative energy storage experiments going on, such as using turbines to pump water uphill when the wind's blowing, so when it's not, the water can be downhill and turn turbines on its own. So will renewable energy be able to overcome these skeptics, and if so, how and how soon?
It's true that wind doesn't blow everywhere all the time, but wind is always blowing somewhere at some time. And one of the key issues of bringing wind energy to market is the transmission. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of how transmission is to getting renewables onto the grid. And so improving the transmission system, and if you have a more robust transmission system, you can move that around. It's also how pricing is done, and that's a more technical issue. But marginal cost pricing for energy and how energy is bought and sold on the market on a very short time frame, looking at those policies can help make sure that renewables are maximized when they're on the grid and when they're available. Most people that are involved with the Great Lakes Wind Collaborative don't think that wind can be the silver bullet, that all of our energy needs can be met with wind. The idea is it's an important part of the region's portfolio, and how can we make sure that that is maximized to the extent it provides stable pricing, the cost of wind won't change, that it's clean, it doesn't use any water, and it doesn't have air emissions associated with it.
Victoria Pebbles is Program Director with the Great Lakes Commission and Mark Cleavy with Great Lakes Wind Collaborative. Thank you both for explaining this to us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
By the way, all week long we've been looking at energy issues in Michigan, solar energy, fracking, coal. You can find those interviews in case you missed them or you'd like to hear them again on the website michiganradio.org. Still to come, we'll hear about an organ convention. That's a pipe organ convention. Yes, there really is such a thing. Coming next to Kalamazoo and Battle Creek, we'll talk about that in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Well, there's a bit of interesting news this hour. It appears Detroit City Council President Charles Pugh is about to lose his job. That's after Pugh did not meet a deadline set by the city's emergency manager, Kevin Orr. Orr had told Pugh he needed to show up to work by 5 p.m. yesterday or be stripped of his salary and responsibilities. Pugh hasn't shown up for work for over a week. He did put in a request for medical leave, but Orr denied it. All of this comes a day after the mother of an 18-year-old student Pugh had mentored accused him of inappropriately giving cash and gifts to her son. Like Detroit politics needs to get more complex. The city of Flint is currently working on a master plan to help shape the city's future in the next 20 years. And part of that plan involves the role of arts. Recently, the National Endowment for the Arts gave a grant to hire 9 artists who live in each of the city's wards to explore the role arts can have in the community and get residents involved in the master plan. Joining us in the studio is one of those artists. Andrew Morton is the artistic director of the Shop Floor Theater Company in Flint. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about your theater company.
Well, we're a pretty brand new theater company. We've just been in existence a little over a year now. Kind of started in the last 12 months with a grant from the Ruth Mott Foundation, one of Flint's kind of local grant-making organizations. Our focus is really on community-based theater, so we do a lot of work with people who aren't necessarily trained actors or performers around exploring kind of community issues. So the last piece that we just kind of finished up early this year was a piece called State of Emergency, which tackled the rather complex and controversial emergency manager legislation. And we kind of told the story of how Public Act 4, how it came out in Flint.
You guys aren't afraid of jumping into controversy at all.
No, you know, yeah, that was our first piece. And we kind of went straight in there with kind of like, where was the kind of need for, what were the hot topics and where was the need for a dialogue? And had a really good response. I mean, we had a lot of people come out. And I guess our feeling is, you know, sometimes people might be a little bit more interested to come out and engage in a dialogue about this type of work if it's coming to see a play rather than going to like a public forum or kind of meeting at City Hall.
Right. So. Now, you've got a lot of volunteers. How's that to work with? I mean, you're dealing with people from, I believe, the 5th District, the Carriage District. What's
So,
to have a all volunteer staff like that?
Well, the project that I'm doing for the 5th Ward project, I'm working with a couple of the people I've started to work with as part of my theater company. But yeah, most of it, it's a kind of volunteer base. My project's in collaboration with social service organization Genesee Health System, which was formerly Community Mental Health. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I really enjoy kind of working with, as I said, kind of populations who aren't necessarily trained actors or performers, but kind of using their own experiences to create work and tell stories.
So the city of Flint is currently working on a master plan, is kind of a blueprint for how to shape the city's future. How does your work play into that master plan?
Well, I'm one of 9 artists that was contracted by the city of Flint in collaboration with the Greater Flint Arts Council to simply try to creatively engage Flint residents in the master planning process. The planning process has been going on now a little over a year. And, you know, we're certainly in terms of the sort of artistic community in Flint, we felt this was a great opportunity to try and merge the sort of great work that's happening in a lot of community arts kind of grassroots projects, trying to use the techniques and the skills that we use as artists to engage populations and link it to this kind of opportunity for civic engagement. The 9 artists were sort of given a task of using their own medium, kind of we had a lot of freedom and type of project that we wanted to do, but basically just try to engage as many people as possible in this process.
As a reporter, I've covered a lot of community meetings. I just can't imagine getting a real big response to those unless, you know, there are signs out and protesters are ready to go and riled up. But this sounds a lot different. So after somebody attends one of the plays, one of the performances, what kind of feedback do you get?
Well, we were also sort of given asked to kind of look at one or two of the focus areas of the master plan and try to focus our work around that. So I can speak kind of specific to the work that I'm doing, where the group I've been working with over the past 2 months now, our kind of main issues we were looking at were transportation and infrastructure in the city, mm-hmm. and health, welfare, and public safety. We kind of been focusing specifically on transportation and kind of health and wellness. Majority of the population I'm working with rely on public transportation as their main means to get around. So the project's kind of brought up a lot of frustrations and kind of identified what's not working and what gets people kind of annoyed or angry and what would they like to see improved. But it's also about kind of recognizing what's working already and trying to think about, okay, from in terms of the work that we're doing as part of this artistic project, so we will kind of create this play. So that's the product in a sense of this piece. But then from that play, there will be suggestions that we will then pass on to the master planning department and they can kind of embed it into the master plan. So from the work that we've done, these are some suggestions that could improve transportation.
Yeah, in what form do those suggestions come? I mean, do you ask the crowd to fill out a card at the end of the performance or how does that work?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of it's kind of twofold. I mean, one, it comes from the participants that have helped me create the play. So the play itself sort of begins at the bus stop, the bus station, kind of central bus station in the city of Flint, where people are going about their days. And then we have kind of four main stories that we see, short little vignettes of because of a missed connection or delay, what happens the rest of their day. Like it's kind of that ripple effect. If you miss the bus and then what happens, you turn up late to work or you miss your doctor's appointments, what kind of happens next? So some of the suggestions have come from the participants' kind of own experiences. But then, yeah, when we do the performance, which is open to the public, we'll kind of have a little bit of a discussion afterwards and say, okay, what were the, to an individual audience member, what was your, who did you connect with the most or which issue are you most interested in? What might be, you know, if we could kind of wave a magic wand right now and fix that problem, you know, what would be a way to do that? So the focus of this work is really, and I think that's kind of why the city wanted to engage artists in this process,
right,
is really kind of articulating like a vision for what we want the city of Flint to look like. And I think artists are very good often at sort of having grand ideas and dreaming about what the world could be like. And at the same time, recognizing, you know, what isn't working, what is working, but also kind of trying to really articulate what we'd like our city to look and be like in the next 20, 30 years.
So you've got an event coming up this Saturday. What's that about?
So the event is titled Artists Imagine Flint, and it's pretty much a celebration of the 9 projects that have happened over the last 2 or 3 months in the city of Flint. It starts at 12 o'clock, 12 noon at City Hall. It's going to take place in a kind of dome space in the rear of City Hall in Flint. And the purpose is really kind of to one, celebrate the work that's already happened in the city of Flint and highlighting the 9 projects. So there'll be performances, videos, activities for children, families, food. But at the same time, what we really want this event to be is a sort of kind of bringing us to the end of this phase of the project, but at the same time trying to show people that the arts are a great way to engage in civic life. And so we'd really want to sort of animate City Hall with lots of activity and life and try to make people feel in the community that, you know, City Hall is a public space. We should be there. We should be actively involved in the, you know, decisions that affect us in the city, and art's a great way to do this. So it's going to be a fun day. Hopefully the weather will be on our side, and we hope it'll be the beginning of sort of trying to creatively engage people in civic life for the foreseeable future.
Give the citizens more voice, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Andrew Morton is one of 9 artists in residence in Flint. He's the artistic director of the Shop Floor Theater Company. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in Flint, Governor Snyder has asked the former emergency manager, Mike Brown, to resume his duties as the EM next week. He'll be replacing current emergency manager Ed Kurtz, who's retiring. Brown served as Flint's emergency manager under the previous emergency manager law that was suspended in 2012. Kurtz has said Flint faces a $19 million deficit. Kurtz steps down on July 3rd, and Brown will take over the job on Independence Day, July 4th. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You know, several years ago, I met this guy whose life passion was pipe organs. Marlon Mackley tuned and built pipe organs. And when we talked, I visited him at his shop, which was actually an old church building, which seemed kind of fitting.
It certainly, I suppose, adds the right feel. It doesn't hurt that I've got a large pipe organ set up at one end of the building either. But when I first found the building, to see 60,000 cubic feet of airspace in one room with no posts, I thought, well, this is terrific. I can put a lot of organ in here. Of course, I succeeded handsomely. It's full.
Recently, he's been involved in a unique project. At the Darden Presbyterian Church, Mackley is helping the congregation build one of the area's largest pipe organs out of parts and the pipes of abandoned organs.
Here, we have the unusual fortune of having almost 70 sets of pipes culled from several medium to large instruments to pick from. Some of this pipe work is over 120 years old and rather rare, and some of it's more current. But it's actually easier to design an organ with this because we know what the pipes sound like now here in the building. We can pick and choose what fits the architecture of the structure by setting up this small test machine we call a voicing machine in the middle of the sanctuary and just try it.
In the basement of the church, volunteers are hefting large pieces of an organ up onto sawhorses to begin repairs. The church's pipe organ project organizer, Jerry Lee, says none of the church's members knows anything about building a pipe organ.
It's the Lord looking after us. I fully believe it, because we've got 50 volunteers, and some of them, their vocation is lawyer, but their avocation is woodworking. Some of them are electricians, and some are carpenters, and some of them are just people that can lift things. And that's what we've been doing, lifting, carrying, sorting, and assembling. We have carried pipe organ pipes and dropped them down elevator shafts 100 feet deep. We happen to have a guy who's into mountain climbing, so he brought his gear, and that's how we got the pipes down.
It's up to Marlon Mackley to play consultant and to tune the organ. He says rebuilding pipe organs is a great job because it's always different, and many skills are needed.
This is the kind of thing that you have to be skilled at: woodworking, tinsmithing, in this case electronics, because we're going to control this with a computerized system, plus all of the normal skills, the tonal skills of a musical instrument manufacturer.
And all those skills will go into putting together the Darden Presbyterian Church pipe organ. When it's finished, the pipe organ will include 56 ranks of pipes, rivaling some of the largest organs on which Marlon Mackley has worked.
Hey, start off up there!
It's a good thing I did some of this earlier, before they got here.
And all joking aside, he's enjoying every minute of it. That exposure to Marlon Mackley several years ago gave me an appreciation for pipe organs I hadn't really had before. You know, I had an appreciation for Hammond B3 electric organs and rock and popular music, but pipe organs, they're not the same. If you can't get enough of the soaring sounds of pipe organs, you're in for a treat. Starting Sunday and lasting through July 3rd, organists from 5 states will be attending and playing in Kalamazoo and Battle Creek for the Great Lakes Regional Convention of the American Guild of Organists, called the Great Lakes Swell Organs. Joining us now is the Secretary of the Program Committee for the group, Brooks Grantier. So why Battle Creek and Kalamazoo? How do we end up there?
You know, often these conventions wind up in the big cities, and that's perfectly fine. They have a lot of good organs there. In this case, we have something unique that most cities don't, and that's organs clustered. In Kalamazoo, located around Bronson Park, this beautiful one-square-block urban oasis in downtown Kalamazoo, there are handsome churches, and every one of them with wonderful instruments. In Battle Creek on Wednesday, July 3rd, you're going to have another half dozen instruments all clustered together within 100 yards of each other. So we call it the Walking Convention.
Yeah, somebody said it was the Kalamazoo Organ Zoo.
It's the Kalamazoo Organ Zoo.
That's nice.
And it's the crown jewels of the Serial City.
So tell us a little bit about some of these organs. What makes them special?
Well, what makes them special is, in the first place, the rooms they're in, which are handsome churches with lovely acoustic ambiance. And the builders are the premier builders in North America, that's for sure. I don't know if your listeners are up on who the big names in organ building, but let me name just a few: Skinner, Letourneau, Ott, Dobson, Casavant and so on and so on. Major important American producers of these great instruments with some of their very finest samples of work in these churches and one auditorium in Kalamazoo and Battle Creek.
I might be a little simple-minded, but when I think of pipe organs, I want to know how many ranks of pipe, how big are these things?
Well, all right, a pipe organ, every pipe in a pipe organ is an individual musical instrument, of course, and they're all handcrafted of wood or metal, and they can only play one note. So it takes a great many of them, anywhere from several hundred to several thousand, to make up a pipe organ. And indeed, we have organs from quite small ones, 15, 16 ranks of pipes or sets of pipes, up to the very large 73 rank sets of pipes in W.K. Kellogg Auditorium in Battle Creek. So it ranges the whole lot. If you want to hear big, fancy, loud, roaring organ music, this is your chance. If you want to hear more intimate sorts of expression on the organ, come again.
Well, we might be familiar with classical music or church organ music or ballpark organ playing. What kind of music can we expect at this convention?
At this convention, you'll find mostly organ playing of the quote-unquote classical style, which would be, of course, J.S. Bach and a whole lot of other composers, including some of our very most modern ones. And this is not ballpark organ music here, nothing wrong with that, but that isn't what you're going to hear here. Nor is this movie theater organ music of the Gilded Age, the Mighty Wurlitzer. Those are fine things, but they're not really a part of this particular focus.
Right. So how would you describe this experience to listeners who might not be familiar with a pipe organ? I mean, I've been in chambers where the resonance is so much, you just feel your whole being shake sometimes because of these low notes on these huge, huge pipes. You were talking about the smaller, intimate organs as well. What can we expect?
All right. Now let's take an example at either end. If you're going in Battle Creek on Wednesday the 3rd, where performances happen all day long from 10 till 7 in the evening, to take your pick, and they're all clustered, as I mentioned, right together. Our 10 o'clock performance is at what's known as the Miller Chapel of the First Congregational Church. It's an intimate little organ of 14 stops in an acoustically perfect environment, and so you just feel this warm, inviting, and rather bright sound enveloping you. At the other end of the spectrum is the very large W.K. Kellogg Auditorium, with the organ by the distinguished American builder Ernest Skinner. In fact, his last large unaltered masterpiece in there. And that organ is equipped with all the big 32-foot-long, loud, big reeds and a lot of the Skinner's famous subtle orchestral-colored stops as well. Our organist for that one is David Schrader of Chicago, who really knows what that organ's all about. And will provide a great variety from extremely soft and refined sounds through the thunderacious big pipes.
How many different organists will be coming in?
There will be a dozen different organists, and it's really the roster of Great Lakes royalty in terms of performers. I will say several U of M grads among them.
That's always good.
Well, of course it is.
Okay, so the Great Lakes Swell Organs will be held in Kalamazoo and Battle Creek starting on Sunday. All performances are free. Open to the public. You can find out more information at agokalamazoo.org. Brooks Grantier, thanks. Good luck with the convention.
Thank you, Lester.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe. It's Just Politics, Clark. Stateside is engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Sua, Katie Thury, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. It's been a great time spending the week with you. Cindy Canty is back on Monday.